Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
Before we begin, I did want to provide a trigger warning for anybody who struggles with orthorexia nervosa, anorexia nervosa, or has fears about eating highly processed foods, that this episode is not directed towards those eating disorders. But instead, this episode is for those who feel as if they may lose control with processed foods to the extent that it leads to the engagement in binge eating disorder, bulimia nervosa, or compulsive overeating. Here at Body Matters, we do promote that all foods should be incorporated within your diet and that they can be included safely when eating disorders resolve and regular eating patterns are introduced. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Caroline.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jess.
So would you be able to give us a little background information about yourself and maybe talk about how you got started?
Okay, sure. I've had two careers. I've had a career firstly as a registered nurse and then as a registered psychologist. And I worked as a registered nurse for 20 years. And during that time, I worked for Abbott Australasia, which is a big medical company. It's a sort of American kind of worldwide company. And I worked in their nutrition division. So I had quite a bit of nutrition training when I was a representative for them with their nutrition division. And the company makes enteral feeds, tube feeds, but their feeds were very specialised and they were for patients who were in intensive care or critical care. So I needed to be able to talk to intensive care specialists and dietitians about what their patients required and sound like I knew what I was talking about. So that's where I got my basic training in nutrition. And then later on, while I was still nursing, I decided on a career change. So I started going to university and did one degree after another, which is what you have to do in psychology. And I got registered in 1999, actually. Yeah, so I've been doing this for, over 20 years, maybe over 22 years.
That is a very interesting entry.
Yes.
Yes. So you have told me that you have been diagnosed with celiac disease. What were your experiences like with celiac disease before being diagnosed?
Oh, like that was a whole, that was awful. I had all the usual symptoms of celiac disease, you know, bloating, you know, let's not get too graphic, but all the gastrointestinal effects, and had no idea. And I felt awful all the time and even went to a gastroenterologist who said, oh, it's just IBS. And I'll do a colonoscopy on you, but of course it won't show anything. And of course it wouldn't show anything because celiac disease affects the small intestine, not the large intestine, which is where you do what you're looking at is the lower part of the large intestine. So that was really unhelpful. And then just by a sheer coincidence, I was seeing an endocrinologist for something else and he did a whole battery of blood tests. And this was back in 2010. And he said, and this was a guy I used to work with because I worked as a registered nurse at the private hospital where he worked. And he said to me, oh, you've got celiac disease. He's looking at the computer screen and looking at these numbers. And I said, no, I haven't. I know all about celiac disease. No, I haven't. And he says, yes, I have. Look at those numbers. And he was looking at the gluten antibodies, which were extremely elevated. And he said, well, you need to go and see a gastroenterologist because the gold standard for diagnosing celiac disease is having the elevated antibodies in a blood test and then having a biopsy of the small intestine. So they do a number of biopsies and then have a look at them. And what happens is that what they'll see under the microscope is that the villi are flattened. So the lining of the small intestine under microscopy looks like a shag pile carpet. But because of inflammation, so, you know, celiac disease is an autoimmune disease. And it's characterized by when the person eats food with gluten in it. So gluten is contained in wheat, barley, oats, and rye. In the US, they don't recognize oats, but in Australia, they do. So wheat, barley, oats, and rye. And our immune system treats that the gluten like it's a foreign antigen. And because gluten is a really tough protein and it's really hard to digest, to break apart. And generally, you know, it just passes through most people. But for some reason, celiacs carry the gene, something switches on that gene, and then we start attacking ourselves. And usually the part that our immune system attacks is the lining of the small intestine. And so celiacs, when they're untreated, then they can't absorb nutrients. And one of the common ways that people are diagnosed is if they present with iron deficiency anemia, which is a common one, or they might even present with a fracture. And I had a fracture, and that's why I was investigated. I fell and fractured my wrist. And then they went and did, you know, bone densities, and I had bone loss and all the rest of it. And that's characteristic of people who've had celiac disease for a long time, because there's a number of really important nutrients that we can't absorb.
Mm.
But anyway, what happened was I have the biopsy and the gastroenterologist says, congratulations, you've got celiac disease. Oh, thanks, but no thanks. And he said to me, this weekend, you can eat as much gluten as you like, because after that, you won't be eating gluten. And so I did what he said to do, and I felt so sick. It was awful.
Oh.
It was so, I'll never do this again. And from then on, you know, my life's been a gluten-free zone, and it's been transformative, because all the gut symptoms went away, the bloating went away, and my brain fog cleared, and it was just magical.
So then on the topic of processed food addictions, what is ultra-processed food?
So what is ultra-processed food? So I'm actually going to, rather than use my own definition, I'm going to have a look at Harvard University. They have a blog on health, and the author of this blog is a registered dietitian. And this blog was written in 2020, and I looked at that and thought, oh, it's got a really good description of processed and ultra-processed food. So we consider, if you categorize food, there's unprocessed or minimally processed food that are whole foods. And so they've got all their micronutrients intact. So all their vitamins, minerals, trace elements are intact. And they are either in their natural state, say like a piece of fruit, say an apple or something like that, or they might be minimally processed. So minimally processed might be, say, cooked. So say like, I don't know, boiling a potato or something like that. Or minimally processed might be cheese, for example, is fairly minimally processed. And then, and most natural unprocessed food it perishes. It has a shelf life. You can't leave it, you know, in the fridge or on the bench indefinitely, because it will start to rot. Minimally processed food might be processing sort of changes the natural state of food, so that they might add things to it or they might cook it. And an example of that might be, you know, tinned fish or tinned vegetables or fruit, you know, fruit in syrup or something like that. And so that the fish might be cooked and then canned, and that prolongs the shelf life. I presume that after a few years that food might be compromised, but you couldn't eat it after that. So that's sort of minimally processed. And usually sort of minimally processed food has only two or three ingredients. I mean, you think about like baking fresh bread, that's usually only got a few ingredients. And we think of that as being minimally processed. But then when you get to highly processed or ultra processed foods, you've got added ingredients like sugar, salt, fat, artificial flavors, artificial colors, artificial preservatives. And then they're made mostly from substances extracted from foods, like fats, starches, added sugars, and hydrogenated fats. And then they can contain artificial colors, flavors, and stabilizers. So examples of ultra-processed food might be salty snack foods, biscuits or cookies, what the US call cookies, soft drinks, you know, cakes that you buy in the shop. Those kinds of foods. And, you know, the first point is, you know, unprocessed food perishes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then how do food industry companies play a role in eating disorders?
Well, you know, we can't say that they play a role, but we think that You know, generally speaking, people who overconsume food, generally they overconsume processed or ultra-processed food, more ultra-processed food. And the food industry employs very smart food scientists to alter food to make it highly palatable. They'll add salt, sugar, fat, and various other ingredients to make that food to be highly palatable and irresistible, because they want to sell their product. And they'll have, you know, pilot studies and like test groups and things like that to find out and try different versions of a particular food to find out which is the most irresistible, because people, they want their customers to keep going back to that food.
And especially if you're only eating ultra-processed food.
Yeah, so what's happening is that ultra-processed food generally is nutrient deficient, even though they might say, oh, it's got added protein or it's got added this or that. It might have lots of added things, but can our body use those added things? I don't know. But if we consume food that's, or we have a diet that's nutrient deficient, our brain will upregulate, increase the appetite regulating hormones that make us want to eat more. So that, you know, our brain is driving us to eat more to get the nutrients we need. And the most important nutrient is protein. So did you want me to talk about protein?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So protein, you know, the macronutrients are protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Micronutrients are vitamins, minerals, and trace elements. And so the most important nutrient we need to eat is protein, because our body can't synthesize it. It can't make it. So protein we get from mostly from animal sources or some plant sources. And within protein, the base elements of protein are amino acids. And so we need amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of all of our cells. So our cells have a life cycle and they need to be replenished. And we need, you know, a fresh source of brand new amino acids to make new cells. And if we don't have enough protein in our diet, our body will literally turn to its stored sources of protein to almost cannibalize ourselves to make new cells. And that would be our muscles, so skeletal muscles. But our big important muscle is our heart muscle. So if people have a diet that's deficient in nutrients, especially protein, their heart can start getting smaller. And their heart can weaken. So that's a very serious consequence of not having enough protein. So protein, there's 20 amino acids and 9 of them are essential amino acids. So that means that our body can't synthesize those amino acids. We have to get it from food. And that's why it's important to prioritize protein when you're sort of choosing what to eat.
So back on highly processed foods, how are the reward pathways in your brain impacted by highly processed foods?
Yeah, so if anyone's seen my talk on YouTube called The Psychology of Food and Overeating, it was a talk I gave at a conference in 2015, and I described there the action of dopamine. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It is a chemical messenger, and what dopamine does is it plugs into dopamine receptors. If you think about a receptor being like a lock and the neurotransmitter being like a key, and the key fits into the lock and switches it on, like, you know, switches on that nerve cells are either on or off. It's a binary system. And the D1 and D2 receptors, because the receptors are now sort of numbered and grouped, and the D1 and D2 receptors are connected to the reward pathways in our brain. But also focusing, paying attention. And we always produce a dopamine response when we're in relation to food, when we eat that food for the first time. And the reason that is because it's a theory, we're not quite sure, but we think that this is correct, is that our brain needs to know that food is safe to eat. So we're paying attention to what it looks like, what it smells like, what it tastes like. You know, does it make us feel sick? You know, does it, you know, put us in hospital, or is it safe to eat? And that's a normal process. But after a few exposures to that food, eating it, our dopamine response is basically, it's not there. You know, we don't get the dopamine response. But food that is highly palatable, i.e. ultra-processed food, we get that dopamine response every time. And people who, say, for substances of abuse, They get a dopamine response every time. It's not like natural, unprocessed food. You might, you know, get that dopamine response. You might enjoy it, but then you're not going to keep going back for it. Yeah. You know, you're not going to compulsively consume food that's nutrient dense. So people very, very, very seldom overeat real food in a consistent way. Occasionally, you know, some of my clients say, oh, you know, I went back for second helpings of this or that, but it was always real food, but they stopped when they were full. Whereas some people, they just keep eating until they're, you know, almost vomiting, and then they'll go back for more because they had this absolute drive.
The only people who have been consistently restricting their nutrients that they may binge on healthy food because their whole body has no nutrients or anything. But for the average person, it's usually just processed foods that they will eat.
Yeah. But so, usually then when you unpack it, it'll only be one or two occasions here and there.
Yeah.
It's not a consistent pattern.
No. So what is the Yale Food Addiction Scale?
Okay, so the Yale Food Addiction Scale is a measure that was developed at Yale University, obviously, by Ashley Gearhart and Kelly Brownell. So Ashley Gearhart is a psychologist, and they wanted to operationalize. So operationalize is a word we use in psychology to say they wanted to create a measurement. So we call psychological tests, we call them instruments or measures. And so they wanted to operationalize, you know, to measure in a consistent way, you know, what was this thing, this food addiction thing? And so they created the Yale Food Addiction Scale. And that scale was actually validated by a brain scans called fMRI, functional MRI brain scans. And they were able to demonstrate that people who scored highly on the Yale Food Addiction Scale actually showed very characteristic brain activity in the reward areas of the brain. So they knew, and that's quite unique in psychology, that you actually get a measure like that is validated by hard evidence. Often, you know, we make diagnoses based on what we see and what people tell us. You know, we don't have hard evidence like doctors have blood tests, x-rays, scans and what have you. But this one is hard evidence. So the Yale Food Addiction Scale is very helpful in measuring this behavior. It was published in 2009, and since then, in 2015, there's been another version of it, version 2, which is updated to be more closely representative of the DSM-5 diagnosis. So DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and it's used in the US, Australia, New Zealand by psychologists and psychiatrists and people working in the mental health space to diagnose. And every so often they will update the version, and the latest version is 5, so it's DSM-5. And so they changed their diagnostic criteria for substance use disorders. And so food addiction has not been included in the DSM-5, and it hasn't been included in the scale, the ICD-10 that they use in Europe. So it's not been included. So it's still a condition under investigation.
But then looking at the Yale Food Addiction Scale, how can food have addictive-like properties?
Well, it's more a behavioural. We're looking at the behaviour, that the person has there's a compulsion to the behaviour. And once the person starts consuming the product, it's hard for them to stop. But the person keeps going back to it. It's like if you think about, say, you know, somebody who's addicted to nicotine, for example. You know, these days you don't see so many people smoking because there's a lot of social pressure not to. The government's put taxes on cigarettes so that they're very expensive. So there's a lot of negative pressure against smoking. But we know that people who develop nicotine addictions, and nicotine's actually good for your brain. It actually switches your brain on and makes it work better. But it's the delivery method of the nicotine that's problematic. So yeah, their brains make more nicotine receptors. But what's interesting is that when you eat ultra processed food, you don't make more dopamine receptors. You just don't. And in fact, and this is a little sidebar, one of the theories about why people are more prone to addiction, there's no such thing as an addictive personality, but they think that simple people's brains might be more susceptible to addiction, is that they have fewer D2 dopamine receptors in their brain. And so they're actually their brain seeking out whatever is going to produce a dopamine response, so that they are more prone. And particularly you see that in ADHD. ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And when you talk about that, you think of boys in classrooms, you know, creating havoc. But ADHD can occur in girls too, more frequently in boys, but more in girls as well. And it, you know, it was once thought that people grow out of ADHD. They don't. I think the research suggests that adults with ADHD may just learn better executive function skills. So ADHD is characterized by poor executive function. So executive function is, if you think about their adult functions. So adult functions would be time management, impulse control, being able to switch from one mental activity to another easily, being focused, being able to concentrate, all of those sort of things. And the part of the brain that is responsible for executive function is called the prefrontal cortex. And that's that bit of the brain that's right in the front where our eyebrows are, and just in underneath there, across the lower part of our forehead. That's where, if you see a brain side on and the bit that juts out in the front just underneath there, that's called the prefrontal cortex. And that bit of the brain is responsible for executive function. And so what happens in ADHD, they think, is that people with ADHD have fewer dopamine receptors in that part of the brain, which means that they have fewer opportunities and places to switch on that part of the brain. Okay? And so we our brain, you didn't expect to get a lesson in brain science, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Our brain's made of, and our nervous system is made of neurons, nerve cells, and they have a cell, a nucleus, and they have a long tail called an axon, and they have like little hair-like structures coming off them, like a bit like an octopus or something, called dendrites. And that long tail called an axon has a fatty sheath around it called a myelin sheath. And so, you know, when you see an electrical cable, for example, and it's got, you know, grey plastic around it, or it could be, you know, like, and what that plastic is doing is it's stopping the electrical current from going anywhere but along the wire. So it's making the electrical current go faster, and it's stopping it from going anywhere. And that's what myelin does. And our brain, what we say, myelinates, it starts myelinating from the time we're born. Our brain starts myelinating, and it myelinates at very specific times. You've heard of milestones, you know, so that most babies will sit up at a certain time, or they'll hold their head up at a certain time, or they'll start pulling themselves up, or they'll take their first steps, or they'll say their first words. And all of those functions are determined by when our brain myelinates. So the thing with ADHD is that girls, that part of the brain, that prefrontal cortex that's involved in executive function, that myelinates, that's one of the last parts of the brain to myelinate, but it myelinates earlier in girls and later in boys. That's why girls seem to be more mature in their late teens than boys in their late teens. You know, males don't seem to get it together until they're well in their 20s, I think, you know. Stuff that they do. Okay. So go back to ADHD and food. And so, you know, you typically see that the things that will increase dopamine response are the things that people with ADHD will engage in. So boys think about, you know, high-risk behavior. Okay. And so even girls, sometimes girls as well, but more you typically associate that with boys. But as people grow up, they learn things that switch that bit of their brain on. And one of the things that happens with females is that females, adult females with ADHD, have much higher rates of binge eating disorder in adult women with ADHD. So in the general population, it's estimated that it's about 4.5% of the general population have ADHD. And so if you took a group of, if you looked at a population of binge eaters or food addicts, you'll find if you tested them for ADHD, particularly in females, you'll find much, much higher rates. And the estimation is about 25%. It's huge. It's absolutely huge.
Wow.
Yeah, it's massive. And I see a lot of, I see a lot of people for binge eating disorder, food addiction, and frequently I see symptoms of ADHD. And when I test them on the standard test, that's a screening tool, they pass with flying colours. Yeah. So what you're doing also too is helping them with their executive function to develop those skills of, you know, managing their impulse control and managing their time and doing all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
So there's something I didn't mention was there's an eating disorder called binge eating disorder, which is listed in the DSM-5, which I referred to earlier. And it's binge eating. We describe binge eating as eating a large quantity of food, a relatively large quantity of food, and relative to what other people would eat in the same circumstances in a relatively short period of time. The person feels like there's a compulsion, a drive to overeat. They can't stop. They wouldn't do it in front of other people because they'd feel very embarrassed if other people saw what they were eating. They might feel quite distressed about what they're doing. Overeating is different to binge eating. Overeating, the person has decided, I'm going to have a second helping of this or a third helping or whatever. Whereas binge eating is this subjective sense of loss of control. But food addiction is something different. With binge eating disorder, there's a specific criteria, and it's about the frequency of the binging in a specific period of time. And what you do to make the diagnosis, you're looking at the previous 3 months, and the person needs to have been binging once or twice a week for the previous 12 weeks, or that there's, I think it's at 10 or 12 episodes within that period, but with no more than a 2 week gap between episodes. And as well as ticking the other boxes of what I previously stated, and we call that binge eating disorder. Whereas food addiction is something different, it's a different animal. And interestingly, you can assess for both conditions, and you may not, you know, not all people with binge eating disorder have food addiction, and not everyone with food addiction has binge eating disorder because they're slightly different. But there is a 57%. Overlap, we call it comorbidity. So comorbidity means occurring together. So there's a 57% overlap. And it's considered that the people who meet the criteria for both conditions have much more disordered eating. They've got higher rates of depression, low self-esteem, negative mood, like negative affect. So affect means how you present to other people. So they're looking sad and down. So they're a much more they're a group that have got more significant problems. But, you know, the treatment's exactly the same.
It's really interesting to differentiate the two.
Yeah, because they are different.
So what about people who compulsively eat the same processed food, such as chocolate? How might you then break this compulsion?
I just do a swap. I get them to do a swap. I get them to swap from... Because as soon as you say to somebody, you can't eat this anymore, you know, the inner dragon of the sleeping dragon of inner rebellion will rise up and say, you can't tell me to do that. You know, I'm not going to listen to you. Whereas if you say, yeah, sure, you can eat chocolate, but let's just try something different. And so if they, and typically people do the, you know, the Cadbury family block, the milk chocolate stuff, I just get them to swap over to something that's got the sugar replacements, probably stevia, so that's not going to be producing a dopamine response. And I also ask them to switch to dark chocolate because it's got less sweetener in it, and it's got more, you know, cocoa powder is great, cocoa butter is great for you, but not too much, just in moderation, you know. But I get them to switch over, and a good brand for that is a brand called Well Naturally, which you can find in, you know, Coles and Woolies and supermarkets, and it's a bit more expensive, but go and buy it on special and just try it and just say, okay, I can eat chocolate, but this is the chocolate I can eat. And what I find in my clients is they report back they eat less of it because they don't have the drive to overeat it the way they would when it's full of sugar. Because once you swap ultra processed food for real food and it's nutrient dense, and we want a variety and they're getting enough protein and everything, what happens is that they notice that their their desire to overeat just goes away because they're getting the nutrients that they require, but they're not consuming ultra processed food, which is hijacking the appetite regulating hormones. So I haven't talked about appetite regulating hormones. I don't know. Do you want me to talk about that? Yeah. Okay. So we have appetite regulating hormones that are released by our brain, our gut, and our fat cells. And they tell us when to start eating and when to stop eating. And they work beautifully. And we listen to them when we eat a diet of natural, unprocessed food, but they get hijacked when you eat a diet that's got large quantities of ultra-processed food in it. Because those clever scientists, they've worked out how to bypass those appetite-regulating hormones to trick our brain into thinking that we need more, we're still hungry, we need to eat more.
Mm. Well, if you're eating a diet of mostly or all ultra-processed food, you're probably not getting too many nutrients. Or
no. The key to success is food that's nutrient dense.
Yes, definitely.
Calories do not tell you what that food does inside your body. Mm. Not at all. And so it's really not a useful measure in any way, shape, or form. It's consistently used. It's persistently used, but it's a really unhelpful measure.
Yeah, especially.
It should be banned from use. Banned.
Especially
in people get obsessed about calories, and it's a meaningless term.
Mm. Especially in understanding nutritional value.
Yeah. Now, the other thing too is that a piece of wood has calories. You can put a piece of wood in a bomb calorimeter, and you can measure the calories in that piece of wood. Like, we don't eat wood, so it's a meaningless term.
Yes. So how can emotional freedom techniques help?
Yes. So I'll add something in here. So when you move people to a real food diet, you're taking away the physiological triggers for overeating. So you take away swap processed, ultra processed food for real food. So you're taking away those triggers, but then what you're left with is the emotional triggers. So, you know, people might overeat because they're feeling stressed, or they're feeling lonely, or they're feeling sad, or for a whole bunch of reasons. They might, you know, overeat ultra-processed food, or they might eat processed food, which ends up overeating, simply because they're working long hours, they're busy, they haven't had time to think about what am I going to have for dinner. So that convenience is the enemy of good eating. If you want to eat well, it requires some thinking, some planning, and some doing. So I unpack that with people and say, okay, how can we set you up to succeed by planning what's happening for the week? What have you got to do? What do you need? Do some shopping. Think about what you're going to do. So, if some people will still find they will still be drawn back to their favorite ultra processed food because it's what they turn to in times of stress. So I use a technique called emotional freedom techniques, EFT or tapping. It is an evidence-based stress management technique. We call it psychological acupuncture. And what it involves is tapping on acupressure points on the head and on the upper body. And there's eight of those points. This is an evidence-based technique, and it beats everything hands down. It is nothing short of brilliant. In Australia, we have an academic researcher, Dr. Peter Stapleton, who's a woman. She's an associate professor of psychology at Bond University, and she's the person who's been doing research on EFT for over 10 years, probably 15 years. I know Peter, and I did my training with Peter, so I have an advanced training in EFT. And she has been able to bring EFT into the mainstream by helping to produce a substantial evidence base. And she has been able to demonstrate through brain scans, you don't remember I said to you, you don't get any better than that, that you can actually produce brain changes with EFT, and particularly for food cravings. And she did a pilot study, which was published just a little while ago, where she took two groups of people. One group were the treatment group, and another group were the non-treatment group. And what they did was that they found out what their favorite food, you know, food that they craved, and they put them in, and the kind of things, you know, like, you know, biscuits, cookies. I know that Americans might be listening to this, so that's, we call them biscuits, you call them cookies, donuts, chocolates, lollies, ice cream, you know, all the usual suspects. And so what they did was they put them in an MRI scanner and they flashed up those pictures to both groups. And they, both groups showed that the reward pathways lit up in their brains. The part of the brain that, you know, registers craving, oh, I want that. Both groups did that. So then the treatment group, they put them through a course of EFT, which is pretty easy to do. And then the non-treatment group, they didn't do anything. So then X number of weeks later, I can't remember how many weeks it was because I haven't read the study for a while, they scanned their brains again, showed them the same pictures. The non-treatment group, just the, we call it a control group, their brain scans were the same as they initially did. But the treatment group, nothing. Like there was no, their brain did not register any areas that you associate with craving, like none. It was switched off in their brain. So then they came back months later to both groups. Of course, you know, the control group, they were offered the treatment later on, but while they were part of the study, they didn't get any treatment. And then months later, they came back to both groups of people and said, how are you going with those cravings? And the control group said, yep, still the same. The treatment group, they said, what cravings? What are you talking about? Because what's interesting is that what EFT tapping does is that it downregulates a part of the brain. Downregulate means to reduce activity in a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is what we call the smoke alarm for stress. But the other thing, the other great thing is that beneath the amygdala is another part of the brain called the hippocampus, where we consolidate a lot of our memories. And so what happens is oftentimes people will turn to a particular food, like an ultra processed food, because it has memories for them, you know, the good memories. And so that's why they're going, they repeatedly go back to that, say the chocolate, for example. But what happens is that when you tap, and if you're tapping on a specific food, and I'm going to give you an example in a minute of one of what I did with a client just last week, which is a perfect example of how this works. And what happens is that you also downregulate the hippocampus in terms of its association with this food. And so the person literally forgets what they were craving. Like it's almost like you're unhooking the emotion from the behavior and they forget it. And if you do it for, you know, say if somebody lists, oh, look, you know, I've got four or five ultra processed foods that I absolutely can't resist. They're my go-tos when I'm feeling, you know, stressed, you know, and whatever, or, you know, I need comfort, they're my go-tos. And if you just need to tap on each one of them, have the food in front of you, and I'll explain how I do that, you get this sort of generalizing effect. So you, after you've knocked off a few, the rest of them just fall over.
Yeah.
And it works like magic. It works like magic. So I'll give you an example. One of my clients who's been working with me for a little while, there's a great deal of trust. We've worked on a whole bunch of issues, but she came back to me and she sent me a text. She said, I really, really, really want to work on this one food. It's a bit out of control. I said, okay, fine. So I said, bring it with you. And so what she brought was, surprise, surprise, some Cadbury milk chocolate. We shouldn't be like, we just say, we're not having a go at Cadbury. I'm sure they make lovely chocolate. But so it was milk chocolate. It was a little small bar of milk chocolate. And so the way you do EFT tapping, it's a combination of cognitive therapy, somatic stimulation. So somatic stimulation, soma means of the body. So it's the tapping on the acupressure points, and then exposure therapy. So exposure therapy is that you're exposing the brain to the thing that's bothering them. So in this case, we're actually describing in words, what's this experience like? So the process when you're working with food cravings is that you get the person to bring this food, and she had a little bar of chocolate. And I said to her, okay, I want you to tell me about this chocolate. I've just landed from Mars. I've never seen this thing, this brown object that you're putting in your mouth. I've never seen this before. Describe to me what it's like. And so she described the wrapping, and she said it looks luxurious, and it was a beautiful color. And she said, you know, it changes color in the light, and then she said, and when I open it up, apparently this particular wrapper, you could sort of, it was self-sealing. You know, if you didn't eat all of it, you could self-seal it so that it stayed fresh. And then she described that. And then she described the smell. And then she had a bite and she described the mouthfeel and the taste. And she described all of the emotions that were associated with eating that chocolate. And there was, you know, lots of, and she started crying. Like she was feeling very emotional about it, about how important this experience was, this chocolate, and what experience it gave her, but also how conflicted she felt about eating it. So when you tap, you create what's called a setup statement. So our setup statement, and a setup statement is like you're giving the bear a poke. You want to upregulate that amygdala. And so a setup statement is in three parts. We always say what if, then we state the problem, and then we put an acceptance statement on the end. And the reason we put the acceptance statement on the end is because oftentimes people keep going back to something can't stop thinking about something because it doesn't make sense to them. Like, why am I doing this? What's going on? You know, I've got a brain. I'm logical. I don't get this. And so our setup statement was, even though I can't resist eating this chocolate, I accept how I feel, or I accept how I feel and I'm open to changing it. And that was our setup statement. So we say that three times while we're tapping on the side of the hand, which is the karate chop point. And what that does, it upregulates the amygdala. It's firing it up. Because then the tapping calms it down. And so the tapping sends a calming signal through the nervous system. And so we start at the eyebrow point, and you know, anyone can go online and look at different, say, the tapping solution or tap with Brad to see how you do it. And so while we were tapping, she was describing to me all those things she said about the luxurious wrapper, that it was self-sealing, that it tasted beautiful. She said it was like a river of chocolate in her mouth. She loved the smell. She was really very descriptive. And she talked about how, you know, it gave her a hug, and it was really important. And we sort of went around, I don't know, about 9 times or something, just saying the same words and describing it. So then at the end, you do a slow breath in and a slow breath out through your nose. And the reason you do that is because it engages the parasympathetic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system controls all of our automatic functions, you know, breathing, digestion, sweating, all that, heart, all that sort of stuff. And it's got two parts to it, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is in charge when we're awake and alert. We call it the fight flight system. And then at nighttime, we do like a switch over, and we switch over to the parasympathetic nervous system. And that's our rest and digest. So we're calmed down, our body temperature drops, our heart rate drops, our breathing drops, and all that sort of stuff. But when you breathe in slowly through your nose, in and out, it engages the parasympathetic nervous system. So it's sending an extra calming signal through the body. What happens then? I said, okay, let's have a look at that chocolate again and tell me what you experience. So the very first thing that she noticed, she said, she smelt it. She said, oh, it smells different. I went, oh, that's interesting. I said, okay, so have a bite and tell me what you think. And she said, oh, it's really, really sweet. I said, you hadn't noticed that before? She said, no, no, no. She said, no, this is actually tasting very, very different. And what happens is that when you do EFT, particularly with ultra-processed food, people describe how they can almost identify the different ingredients. It's quite extraordinary, because what you're removing the emotional attachment to the eating that thing, that food, and you're just, it's like you're eating it for the very first time. And she said, I can't eat this. This tastes awful. It's too sweet. It just doesn't taste right. And she said, I have to throw this out. And she put it in the bin. And I have seen that repeatedly. And she was in floods of tears. She said, you've just taken away one of my favorite treats. I went, I didn't do it. You just yeah. And that's how it works.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like voodoo, but we've got brain scans to prove that it works.
So then what are some helpful tools for someone who may identify as feeling though they are addicted to highly processed foods?
Have you ever heard of John Gabriel? John Gabriel is a guy who, he created what's called the Gabriel Method, and he never tells people to stop eating something. He just keeps adding in, you know, real unprocessed food that's nutrient dense. So if you keep adding that in, you literally crowd out, i.e. ultra-processed food.
Yes.
That's the idea. And even if you just start with just one meal, just do one thing, you know, just see how you go, and then just gradually increase. But you can use techniques like the EFT, and the places that you can go to are online. There's a website and there's a YouTube channel called The Tapping Solution. And Jessica Ortner has written a great book, so you can go and check her out, O-R-T-N-E-R. You can also go to the YouTube channel Tapping with Brad. And he's got hundreds of videos of tapping sequences that go for about 10 or 15 minutes, dealing with all sorts of problems. Because oftentimes, you know, people will reach for the chocolate bar or whatever it is because they're experiencing distress. So rather than, you know, let's get to the core of the problem and deal with the core of the problem. And so tapping can be very useful for that. And sometimes when people are tapping, they connect the dots and they realize, oh, I know what's bothering me. You know, and they have some revelations about, it's like their brain clears and they can figure out what's bothering them. Or you can go and see a psychologist.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for this interview. It's been amazing.
Oh, thank you very much, Jessica, for inviting me.
Yes.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.